Hello, and welcome back to Bench to Bedside. I'm your host, Dr. Susan Firth, Executive Vice President and Chief Scientific Officer of the Research Institute. So to start, I'd like to give our listeners a bit of CHOP history. In 1922, Dr. Joseph Stokes Jr. began the first research lab at CHOP. Dr. Stokes was our second physician in chief, and he is credited with transforming the hospital into a world leader in pediatric research and medical education. Similar to today's guest, Dr. Stokes spent most of his career studying infectious disease with a focus on vaccine development. I'm excited to introduce Dr. Paul Offit, director of CHOP's Vaccine Education Center. Dr. Offit is an internationally recognized expert in the fields of virology and immunology. He is co-inventor of a landmark vaccine achievement for the prevention of rotavirus gastroenteritis. Welcome, Dr. Offit. There's a long history of vaccine research here on our campus, and I know you have written extensively about vaccine development. Looking back, as we're embarking on our 100th year of the CHOP Research Institute, can you tell me about vaccine development when Dr. Stokes, who started the Research Institute, was starting his lab, what it would have been like then, and how it's evolved over time?
Dr. Stokes' major accomplishments were he took gamma globulin, what we today call convalescent serum, and he showed that you could treat infectious hepatitis, what we would now call hepatitis A. He showed that you could treat polio, which at the time we didn't have a vaccine for yet. So he was doing this work in the 1940s, where he showed that gamma globulin or convalescent serum could help patients early on in the course of polio. There were other early researchers then too, Werner and Gertrude Henley. That was an amazing discovery. Henley's discovered was they were working with Epstein-Barr virus. They knew that Epstein-Barr virus caused lymphoma. They knew that Epstein-Barr virus caused nasopharyngeal carcinoma. But nobody knew the cause of infectious mononucleosis, even though it had been described for 100 years. While they were working on Burkitt's lymphoma and nasopharyngeal carcinoma, the technician who came in offered his serum as a control for these patients who had cancer. As it turns out, he actually had mono at the time. And that's how this discovery of Epstein-Barr virus as a cause of mono was made. That was made here at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
Wow, that's impressive. And it's serendipity.
Often the case, right? Yeah. Serendipity. Right? Chance favors the prepared mind. I think yes. That was Louis Pasteur.
So you have made major breakthroughs in vaccine research, as have others. Can you tell me a little bit about the Research Institute at CHOP and how that supported that work?
Sure. I was fortunate enough to be part of a team headed by Stanley Plotkin and Fred Clark that created the strains that became the rotavirus vaccine. So rotavirus is a cause of fever, diarrhea, vomiting in young babies. In this country, it accounted for about 75,000 hospitalizations from dehydration or water loss every year and about 60 deaths. But in the world, rotavirus is the single biggest killer of babies, killing about 500,000 people every year, as many as 2,000 babies a day. We created that vaccine. It was recommended for all children in this country by the CDC in 2006. It was recommended for all children in the world by the World Health Organization in 2013. But like all discoveries, there's no Einsteinian leaps. You are building yourself up based on the hundreds of researchers in that field before you. You just happen to be the one standing up when the music stops. And I was fortunate enough to be able to work with people like Stanley Plotkin, who had already made a vaccine. Dr. Plotkin made the RA27-3 strain of rubella vaccine, which was licensed and recommended in this country in 1979. Rubella or German measles, every year would cause 20,000 or so children to be born with birth defects if mothers were infected in the first trimester, permanent defects of the eye, ear, heart. It would cause spontaneous abortions. Mothers would lose their babies because they were infected in the first trimester with this virus. Because of that vaccine introduced in 1979, we eliminated rubella from this country by the year 2005. That's the power of vaccines.
It's hugely impactful in public health. It's made enormous differences in our country and worldwide. It's really one of the most powerful tools available. So can you tell me what led you to rotavirus?
I came here at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in 1980. There was an ongoing project about rotaviruses. And interestingly, the veterinarians knew that rotaviruses were a pathogen from the 1940s. And so all the research that had been done up to that point was pretty much done by large animal veterinarians. The virus was only discovered to be a human pathogen in the 1970s. So there was much to learn about rotavirus. I chose that because it was such a wide open field. Under the tutelage of people like Fred Clark, who was a brilliant viral pathogenesis person, over 10 years, we figured out the genes that made you sick, the genes that made proteins that protected you, and then created these reassortant strains, these hybrid strains that had the animal virus parts that couldn't cause disease in children, but included the human virus parts that were associated with protection. Thus describing 10 years worth of work in about 45 seconds, which is a little depressing that you can do that, but it took about 10 years to make those strains and then 16 years to do the research of development, which was done with Merck and Company. So that was a 26-year program, which is why when they isolated SARS-CoV-2 in January of 2020, and had two large clinical trials that showed it worked 11 months later, I was a little jealous of how quickly that went.
I'm not sure that everybody recognizes the comparison to the usual timeline. What enabled that?
Money. I think Operation Warp Speed was an $11 billion gift by the federal government that basically took the risk out of it for pharmaceutical companies. So what Operation Warp Speed did was it paid for those phase three trials, which cost hundreds of millions of dollars. It paid to mass produce that vaccine at risk, meaning that if the vaccine didn't work or it wasn't safe, the government was willing to throw away hundreds of millions of doses because they would take that risk. Had that been true, say, for our vaccine, it would have been much faster too. But pharmaceutical companies usually go stepwise. Phase one, meaning to get the right dose, get the right dose ranging, get the right number of doses. Then you do phase two studies where you look at hundreds of people. Then you do phase three studies. I mean, our study, the rotavirus vaccine study, is a phase three study, was a prospective, placebo-controlled, 70,000 child, 11 country, probably $350 million trial. But that took 4 years. The human papillomavirus vaccine trial took 7 years. These vaccine trials took 3 months. So it's because the government took the risk out of it for the industry.
You speak so eloquently about vaccines and the power of vaccines, and I know you lead the Vaccine Education Center here at CHOP. So can you tell us about that and some of the amazing things that you're doing there to help educate people?
Sure. It was born in the year 2000 when I was a voting member on the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, which advises the CDC. And during the first few years that I was there, it was like the 1-2-3 hit on vaccines. Andrew Wakefield, a British gastroenterologist, claimed that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine caused autism. And so there was a push to try and separate that vaccine into its three component parts. There was a rotavirus vaccine that preceded ours that was found 10 months after it was first given to be a rare cause of intussusception or intestinal blockage. And then thimerosal, an ethyl mercury containing preservative that was in some vaccines and was starting to be in more vaccines, precipitated this move by the Public Health Service to basically ask pharmaceutical companies to take it out of vaccines given to young children. What upset me about all that was not the pediatricians. The pediatricians were great. They stood up on television or in front of the media and said, look, vaccines are good. Vaccine preventable diseases are bad. I give vaccines to my own children and you should give them too. But what I didn't see when I was there during this time, when a lot of companies were leaving vaccines because of that 1-2-3 hit, were scientists. Where were the scientists standing up? Not only to say that vaccines are important and vaccine preventable diseases are bad, but to say that here's why it doesn't make biological sense that MMR would cause autism or that thimerosal would cause developmental damage. Where were those scientists? And so we formed here at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in 2000, the Vaccine Education Center, to gather scientists together to interact with the media and with the public to try and counter all that misinformation that was out there, which was like trying to stop Niagara Falls with a paper cup. But we keep trying.
Your career, you started at the bench, you developed this really impactful vaccine, and now you spend a great deal of time doing a different kind of work with different impact. Tell me about that transition. Do you miss the bench part?
It's funny. I still dream about being in the lab back 25 years ago when I first started. I do miss it. It was the most fun time of my life as a scientist because doing science is this great process of discovery. It's in many ways selfish. You sort of pursue your own interests and you're trying to answer your own own questions. And it's every day and it never feels like work. It's this 1,000-piece puzzle and you're trying to put one piece in it at a time. And every day is exciting, even though it's often sort of two steps forward and one step back all the time. It's still really fun. I think this is also fun for me. I mean, I think it is upsetting to me that we see occasionally children come into our hospital whose parents have chosen not to vaccinate them. It put them unnecessarily in harm's way because they've gotten bad information. So I think in many ways it was easier to make a vaccine than it was to convince people to get them. But nonetheless, I think that's something I do. I've written a number of books on this subject, and that sort of gives me a platform. So it's been an education about how to communicate science to the public, which is incumbent upon us.
So you've had enormous impact from the research that you've done at the bench, from your career in communicating about the importance of vaccines and helping the public understand the COVID vaccines. You've had enormous impact. What's your advice to investigators who are just starting out studying infectious disease or disease prevention careers?
Do what's fun. Do what you enjoy. Don't think about money. Just think about, you want to have a work day that doesn't feel like work. Ultimately, we do need to be involved with explaining what we do to the public. I think the degree to which you have a certain expertise gives you a platform to explain that to the public. And there is no venue too small. Just anytime you see a newspaper article, magazine article that you think is wrong, make a call. Call the editor, call the writer. Get involved. When my daughter was in the eighth grade, her biology teacher asked me to speak at her class to discuss vaccines. And so that's the kind of venue I'm talking about. It was probably the most harrowing talk I've ever given, actually, because, you know, 19 children seem to be enjoying it, but just one looked at me, my daughter, with a look on her face and said, "Do not embarrass me in front of my friends." Actually, it was less intimidating being on the Colbert Report than it was talking to my daughter's eighth grade class.
We're so fortunate that individuals like you started their career at CHOP, stayed at CHOP, and have really, really make us so proud of what we can do here. Can you tell us a little bit about what brought you here, has kept you here, has inspired you to build your research career here at CHOP?
I succeeded because I was at CHOP. My mentor at the time was Dr. Stanley Plotkin, who developed the rubella vaccine, who I was working with on the rotavirus vaccine, who did seminal work on anthrax and what has become the anthrax vaccine, did seminal work on rabies and what became the current human diploid cell rabies vaccine. And there were people like John Sieber here, who was a mucosal immunologist. The Penn and CHOP and Wistar research community was just a great community in which to thrive. That's what enables you to thrive, or the people that you're surrounded by. If I was to any extent able to succeed, it was because of the people who I got to meet here at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in the Penn community.
With the work that you do now, again, so important, particularly in our environment where there's so much misinformation and different voices out there, how do you measure success? What keeps you going when you're sometimes fighting what must seem like a lot of misinformation out there?
So there's two answers to that question. The one that I can easily give to the media is, I work in a hospital where I see children suffer and occasionally die. And when you see that, and it's preventable, in this case, by having gotten a vaccine, it's really hard to watch that. And so that is a motivator. But I do think, in part, the scars of our childhood become the passions of our adulthood. When I was 5 years old, I was in a polio ward for about 6 weeks. I didn't have polio. I was born with clubbed feet, which is this congenital abnormality where your feet turn down inward. And there was a surgery that was performed on my right foot that probably never should have been performed. It was botched. And so I ended up in this ward for 6 weeks. And this was the 1950s. It's not like there were therapy dogs or iPads or televisions even. There was one visiting hour a week. My father was a traveling salesman, so he wasn't able to come. My mother was sick with a pregnancy with my brother, so no one visited me. And I remember just lying there and seeing these other children, iron lungs and traction, vulnerable, helpless, alone. And I think I, at some level, always see myself in this, and that's probably part of what drives it.
Wow, that's an amazing story. And unfortunate that that happened, but it's terrific that that's an inspiration. All of us who take care of children, I think that's what brings us to work every day and trying to change the outcomes for kids that aren't so fortunate to have diseases that we currently treat or manage well. So thank you, Paul. It's been great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Susan.
Please join me next time for a conversation with CHOP President and Chief Executive Officer Madeline Bell. You'll hear her thoughts on why pediatric research is a guiding star at CHOP.